Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Torah Studies. Today's topic is Pesach, Passover. This is the second session of our Pesach boot camp. We are going to get you in shape. Pesach is just around the corner. And when I say around the corner, I mean in the next, 48 hours? I don't want to frighten anybody. Chas v'sham, God forbid, it's not frightening. It should be a beautiful thing. Literally, it's 48 hours from now. We'll be gathered. We'll have a community seder. You may be at your own seders, wherever you're going to be. But it's going to be right around now, 48 hours from now. So it behooves us, it's appropriate to talk about the holiday and all things Pesach. Today, you're in for a real treat, and I'll tell you why. Our topic is consumer culture, balancing mind and matter. I don't like the topic so much, so here's what we're going to do. I'm going to share with you, this is amazing. The book that I'm holding in my hand is called Rishimos. Check this out, Rishimos. You see it? Okay, what is this? Rishimos means notes. What notes? Here we go. When the Rebbe passed away in 1994, so those that it was appropriate for them to go into those spaces, went into his office, went into his house, went into his room, whatever, to clean up, whatever it is. And they came across notebooks of the Rebbe's writings and the Rebbe's Torah that were never before published. Private notes, personal notes that he wrote for himself in various journals, various notebooks. Now, this is not like diary stuff. This is Torah thoughts, insights, stories that he heard from his father-in-law, the previous Rebbe. Some of them were outlines of speeches that he gave in various places, pretty much all before he became Rebbe. So what we're going to do tonight is study. And then it was subsequently published. It was published in a very interesting way. It had to be explained, annotated, and then published. Here you have, if you want to see the Rebbe's handwriting, this is the Rebbe's Hebrew handwriting. You can look at it after the class. You can look at it a little bit closer. You see that? See that? How small and tight? It's very precise. It's beautiful writing. And also, you can see it's written on what type of paper? See the type of paper? Graph paper. The Rebbe wrote it on, you know, like mathematical graph paper? The Rebbe was an engineer also. I don't know if you know this. The Rebbe had a degree in engineering from Sorbonne University, and he was an engineer at the Brooklyn Naval Yard back in New York when he moved to New York. Anyway, etc. So the Rebbe wrote this. It's beautiful, beautiful handwriting. It's so precise. So the Rebbe wrote his notes in journals and notebooks, and some of them were on graph paper. And then they were published. So really each, they pulled out certain pieces, and there are multiple volumes of this. Basically, they published it in the original text. They published word for word what the Rebbe wrote, and then they went back in and then explained it with footnotes and added their own words of explanation, kind of bridging the words so that it's more understandable. This Rishima, this journal entry, if you will, that we're going to study tonight, was written in, hold on, the city is called, maybe you can help me out where this is. Okay, Pesach Tavshin Aleph, Passover 1941, and it was written in the city called Nitza. Nitza.
Doesn't that mean like bud?
No, this is a city. This is Nitza. Maybe it's Nice. Nice, France. Because there's another entry right before it from Paris. So I'm thinking Nitza, maybe Nice. I may be wrong. Maybe it's another city somewhere in Europe. But anyway, this is written in Pesach, Passover 1941. Okay, so let's begin. That's where it comes from. Here's what we're going to study. We're going to begin, before we get to Pesach, before we get to Passover, let's explore a contradiction that we find in Jewish thought. And the contradiction pertains to how worldly should we be? How steeped in materialism should we be? This is a constant, this is a source of tension for most of us, the tension between materialism and maybe what we would call spiritualism. You know, how material are we going to be? How spiritual are we going to be? How into food are we going to be? How into tefillah, prayer, are we going to be? You know, are we going to spend time, washing our car? I'm thinking about car washes now for Pesach, but that's another thing. Are we going to spend time buffing, right? And putting the wax on, wax off, whatever, on the car? Or are we going to spend time studying Torah? And it's not necessarily one or the other, but the question is in general, how much are we into materialism versus not into materialism? So we're going to present now conflicting sources in Jewish thought. We have some sources that seem to indicate that we should not be at all involved in materialism, only the bare minimum, and some sources that seem to indicate that we should. Why not? If it's permitted, go for it. If it's kosher, enjoy it. Indulge. Why not? It's kosher. Two conflicting approaches to our materialistic involvement. Let's begin. Marnin, please get us started at page 252. Text 1A, this is in the booklets, text 1A from the book of Leviticus.
And God spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the entire congregation of the children of Israel, and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy."
Okay, so Moses, God is telling Moses to tell the people, "Kedoshim tihyu, be holy." Now that's a very vague term. If I told you to be holy, what would that mean to you? Sorry, forget that question. What could it mean to you? How many things could that mean? Do we agree that it's a little bit open-ended? The commandment, be holy? What do you want me to do? Levitate? Meditate? What does it mean to be holy? Give tzedakah? Pray? But it's open-ended. What kind of mitzvah is that? Every mitzvah is specific. I mean, more or less. It's giving me guidance, what I should do. What's this business, be holy? What do you want me to do? What's the actionable item here?
It sounds like the whole kit.
Okay, but then it's a general mitzvah. What's the specific mitzvah? So, I know I'm asking the question, but this is a question, this is an issue that all of the commentaries, these are the opening verses of a Torah portion in Leviticus called Kedoshim, which means holy. Kedoshim to you, be holy. Kedoshim is holy. What does it mean? All the commentaries struggle with this. So let's explore. Marnin, please read text 1b. Here is what Rava in the Talmud says about this. He explains what it means to be holy. By the way, the translation, the punchline, is incorrect, which is very ironic. But read text 1b and then I'll correct it.
Rava said, "Sanctify yourself by refraining from that which is forbidden to you."
Sanctify yourself by refraining from that which is permitted to you. So Rava says like this, "Kadesh atzmecha b'mutar lach." Let me explain. I know right in front of you it says forbidden, but strike that from the record, erase that from your mind, and what it means is, Kadesh asmucha b'mutar lach. Make yourself, sanctify yourself by refraining from the mutar, from the permitted. What does that mean? Okay. So, to understand this, we're going to look at Nachmanides, Ramban. Nachmanides, of course, is the Torah commentary. He was born in 1194. You see that died in 1270. He was one of the Rishonim, one of the early sages post-Talmudic era, and he is an authority on Torah thought, and this is what he writes about this mitzvah text. One more, Marnin, if you don't mind.
The Torah prescribed certain sexual practices and forbade certain foods, but it permitted relations with one's wife and the consumption of meat and wine. Now the glutton may therefore find license to be lecherous with his wife or his many wives, inebriated with wine and gored with meat. He might speak profanity without compunction, since the Torah records no such prohibition. And in the process, he would be considered a vile and desolate person that is nevertheless acting within the boundaries of the Torah. Therefore, this verse, "You should be holy," is mentioned after the Torah has detailed all the activities that are to be curtailed entirely, but it presents us with a general and comprehensive command that we are to be separated from overindulgence.
Thank you. So Nachmanides, Ramban, is telling us that after the Torah and the previous Torah portion talks about what you cannot eat, the Torah then says, even what you can eat, kadoshim to you. Be holy. Be a mensch. Even though you could say, but it's kosher. It's permitted. Everything that, the wine is kosher, the food is kosher, the wife is kosher, right? Nothing's forbidden here. So, indulgence. The Torah says, in the next Torah portion, right after the what's prohibited, it says, Kedoshim Tiyu. And Rava says in the Talmud, Kadosh Asma B'Mutarlach, even if it's permitted, sanctify yourself. There's a famous, I don't think it's in here, a famous statement that Hasidim used to say. It's text 3. Okay, we'll get there in a second. Text 3. In other words, Ramban is telling us that somebody can be, the word that he uses is a novel. He can be a despicable person, Rishus HaTorah, with the Torah's permission. He can be a person that is an unbecoming human being. He can be not a good human being, but he can say, I didn't do anything wrong. According to Torah law, I violated no such prohibitions. So I'm within permitted territory. So therefore the Torah says, according to these commentaries, the Torah says, no. Kedoshim tiyu, be holy. What that means is kadesh atzmecha b'mundalach, make yourself holy in the realm of the permitted. In other words, within the realm of the permitted, not everything has to happen. You don't have to eat so much. It's not even so much. It's about the way he writes it. Inebriated with wine, gorged with meat. In other words, there's certain decorums that we can take upon ourselves, and that makes us holy according to this line of reason. So, if I ask you, according to what we've learned so far, when it comes to materialism, how should the needle point? To a lot of materialism or minimal materialism? Max materialism or minimal materialism? Minimal. Let's take a look at another text, text number 2. Howard, please read text 2, page 254. So this comes from, thank you, this comes from Pirkei Avot, Ethics of Our Fathers, and it says there, what is the path of Torah? Minimalism. Look at it. Eat bread with salt. That's it. That's your meal. A little bread with salt. Drink water in small measure. You can't even drink, can't even hydrate. Right? Sleep on the ground. Oh, wait, what about my Craftsmatic? Do they still make that? Remember the old adjustable bed commercials? Right? It's like, oh, I'm folded up. They make fancier ones, whatever. They have sleep numbers, right? They have sleep number beds. And then you have online beds that you can buy, which you don't even try out. They have the foam beds that come in a little thing. You open it up, and it opens up. Casper. You know Casper? Huh?
Convert to a Casper convertible.
What is that? Is that a bed?
Yes, it's a sofa bed.
Sofa bed, there you go. You have water beds. Remember water beds were a big deal for 5 minutes back in the day? Until people realize it's not good with keys and whatnot, and whoops.
And cats,
right? Exactly. Anyway, so don't even drink on a mat. Drink. Don't even sleep on a mattress. Don't drink your water bed either. But don't sleep on a mattress. Sleep on the ground and live a life of hardship. Pas b'melech tochel, b'mayim b'mesura tishta. Vala oris tishan, sleep on the ground. V'chayit tsa'ar tichye, live a life of tsa'ar. Tsa'ar means pain. Live a life of pain. And if you do so, ashrecha v'tovlach, it's good for you. You'll be happy and blessed in this world, the world to come. So again, what is this advocating? If we had to move the needle one way or the other, minimal materialism or maximum materialism? Come on, what is this? Very, very minimalistic. This is, you know, the whole movement for tiny houses? This is beyond tiny houses. This is tiny floors. This is tiny earth. This is camping all year round, right? you don't have much food, you're just kind of winging it, and whatever, and that's it, and that's what it is. Text number 3, along the same lines. Charna, take it away. 254.
Chassid Rabbi Mordechai Marodiker related the first aphorism we heard from the Alter Rebbe when we arrived in Leozna was, what is forbidden is forbidden, and what is permitted is unnecessary.
I just want to stop you for a second. Listen to that line. What's forbidden is obviously forbidden. What's permitted, you don't need. You see that? Continue, sorry.
For some 3 or 4 years, we labored with this until we integrated this manner of service into the various aspects of our lives. Only then did we enter into
Yehudot.
To ask for a patch in Avodah.
So Reb Mordechai Haradukar said, when we got to the Alter Rebbe for the first time in Liozhna, where he was for a while before he went to another place, so we arrived there. So the first thing we had to work on for 3 or 4 years, first thing is, in Yiddish, was men tarnit, tarmenit. What you can't have, you can't have. Und was men meg, and what you can have, darf menit, you don't need. And only once we lived with that, took it to heart, not only took it to heart, and like, oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense, but lived it for 3 or 4 years, then we were permitted to have a face-to-face with the Alter Rebbe to ask him, what is my path in divine service? What is our path? What is the individual path that I have in my Avodas Hashem in divine service? That's the Rebbe's entry for the 25th of Adar in his Hayom Yom, which is presents it's a wonder, incredible work, inspiration for each day. Okay. So what do we see? Again, according to this Hasidic aphorism, this Hasidic saying stemming from the Alter Rebbe, if we had to point the needle, minimalism or maximalism, which is not a word, I don't think, but minimal materialism or max materialism, how are we pointing the needle?
Way minimal,
right? You can't have what you can't have, and even what you can have, you don't need it. Let it go. Okay, so far, texts 1, 2, and 3 are advocating minimal materialism. Karen, that's all you need to know.
That's all I need to know.
Minimalism, so far. Okay. Then text 4, 5, and 6 present the other picture, the other side. The point is to get confused. The point is to show how Jewish thought really gives mixed messages. Sometimes it seems to say, you don't need food. Just bread and water. Maybe a little salt there on the side. What do you really need? You don't need much. On the other hand, text number 4. Karen, we're up to you. Page 255. Perfect timing.
Rabbi Dimi says, yeah, the name of Rabbi Yitzchak is what the Torah has forbidden, not enough that you assume further prohibitions upon yourself.
So here was a guy that wanted to take extra vows and say, I don't want this. He says, wait a second. The Torah already gives you prohibitions. You want to add more? If it's permitted, enjoy it. That seems to be the upshot of this. If it's permitted, don't add on to God. Now, we find this in an interesting fashion expressed when it comes to the Nazir. Who is the Nazir? Torah tells us that there's a person who might vow, take a neder, take an oath, and vow, a vow of abstention to not drink wine or any grape product. No wine, no haircuts, and no coming in contact with impurity or death. And a person could take that oath for any duration of time. A person could say that they want to become a Nazir for a week, a month, a year, multiple years. If they took the vow of being a Nazir, then they were forbidden to drink wine, get a haircut, and come in contact with the impurity of death. And when a person's term of Nazir is over, because let's say they said it's for a year, and let's say the year comes to an end, to get out of the oath required a process. And part of the process was bringing offerings in the temple. And one of the offerings in the temple was a sin offering. And so the Talmud addresses, why does the Nazir bring a sin offering? What sin did he or she commit? Before we get into text number 5, I want to ask the following question. Who was a famous Nazir in history? Who's a very famous? Samson. All right. Until his wife gave him the old haircut. By the way, I had no idea this was coming. This haircut. I woke up this morning. Boom. I don't know. I have no idea how the Seder is going to go now. Could go either way. No. All right. Text number 5. Sindrine, you up to reading? 256. Thank you. So Rabbi Elazar Kapar says like this, when the Torah talks about the Nazir and says when he gets out of his oath, period of time that he took this oath, so he brings offerings and it says it should atone for him. Why atonement? Because he sinned. What was the sin? The sin is that he took something that God said you can have and he said, I'm not going to have it. And by turning away God's offer, that's a sin. If that's true with wine, the Talmud says, how much more so someone who fasts? Somebody says, I want to be holy, so today I'm not going to eat. God says you're allowed to eat. You're abstaining from God's food. Talmud says, that's a sin. It doesn't say it's the worst sin in the world, but it says, Nikra Chota, he's called a sinner. So, if we had to now put the needle on the old materialism materialometer, right? So, is this advocating minimal materialism or enjoying materialism? What would you say? Enjoying materialism, right? They're saying, enjoy it, don't abstain. It's considered a sin. Before we said, same thing, text 4. Has the Torah not forbidden you enough that you put on more prohibitions upon yourself? Take it easy, enjoy it. One final text to make us even more confused. Text number 6. Lolly, if you're up to it, please read text 6, page 257. Look at that. After 120 years, there's going to be the grand court case on high in the assessment of a person's behaviors and actions and choices. And the Talmud says, Rabbi Chizkiah, Rabbi Cohen, in the name of Rav, said that a person will have to answer, litein din v'cheshbon, will have to give a judgment and an accounting for everything that he saw and didn't eat. What's the implication? What are you supposed to do?
Live it up.
Live it up. Eat what you see. If you see it, as long as it's kosher, right? If it's kosher, you see it, you should eat it. And if you don't, you're going to have to account for it. So now we're totally confused. Because now it seems to advocate very strong materialism. We have texts on one side and texts on the other side. And if you study all the texts, you can walk away a very conflicted Jew. Very conflicted Jew. Right? It's like I'm being schlepped in different directions. You know what they say. You've heard this from me before. What's a well-balanced Jew? Well-balanced Jew. Someone with a chip on both of his shoulders. So that's the worst. Yeah.
No, I was going to ask, is this in reference to consuming as an eating? Or because this is really pre-consumerism. So
it says, he'll have to answer for everything that his eye beheld, and he did not consume. Oh, no. In the Hebrew, it's achal. It's ate. I don't know, consume. That's like a fancy... That's making it more complicated. It's literally, he's going to have to answer for everything he saw... V'lo achal, and he didn't eat. Achilas, eating. He'll have to answer for everything that he saw and didn't eat. So it's advocating eating everything that you see. Again, assuming that it's kosher, right? So we're saying, eat what you see. Don't take a vow of the nazir, of the abstention. And gosh, Torah forbids you enough. Don't add more. Enjoy it. on the one hand. On the other hand, texts 1, 2, and 3 say, Kadesh asmecha b'mutar lach, sanctify yourself, make yourself holy with that which is permitted. Even though it's permitted, you don't need it. Sleep on the ground, eat bread with salt, a little bit of water, live a life of pain and affliction. Well, that seems to advocate...
asceticism.
Yeah, asceticism. That seems to advocate fasting and self-affliction. So what is it? Are we supposed to live it up or not live it up? So confusing. And you could answer, theoretically, well, it depends who you ask. Some sources say yes, some sources say no. Okay, but what's the Jewish way? So to understand this, we need to turn to the Seder. This is a Passover class, a Pesach class, so of course it's going to come around to the Seder. There are three things that are primary to the Seder. In fact, in our Seder, we say at a certain point in time, right in the middle of the Seder, we say in the Haggadah that if you don't say these three things, then you haven't fulfilled your obligation on the night of Passover. You've not had a Seder until you've said these three things. What are they? Good. Well, you're done for the year. Yeah, you're allowed to do it within 48 hours. It's counted. You're good. Kidding. You have to do it Leil Seder at the night of the Seder. We're going to do it together on the Beltline. Here's the thing. You have to say three things. Pesach, Matzah, Maror. These are the three primary mitzvot, eating mitzvot of the Seder. What is the Pesach? The Paschal offering, the Paschal lamb, back in the day. Matzah, of course. It's the Matzah. And maror is bitter herbs. Why was herb so bitter? Why was Uncle Herb so bitter? Herb. He worked hard. It's better that way. Anyway.
We used to have this is a few seders I went to as a little girl. There was this couple, and the man was he was German, and his wife was not. And every time he would leave the seder, and every time he got to herbs, he'd say herbs. And then his wife would say, "Mark, it's herbs, not herbs."
Full disclosure, in South Africa, apparently, they say herbs. So I'm in the same boat. I'm like, herbs. I don't even care. Like, it's not a thing. It is what it is. You know, I can relate. Yeah, but there's a lot of words that are different. There's a whole lot of words.
I think I know why God created Jewish mothers. Because if we're supposed to consume what we see,
right,
the Jewish mother's job to remind you.
Yes, you got to eat that. You got to finish your food. Oh my gosh, I remember my grandmother of blessed memory. So she would never put down food. Forget about a holiday, even Shabbat, even a regular meal. She would never, especially Shabbat, she wouldn't put like a plate or a platter of chicken or whatever it is on the table. She would make everyone's plate. She would stand in the kitchen, she would work very hard, and she would plate every plate, like a restaurant. And she would plate a lot of food because she didn't want to leave it up to us. She also had a thing where she would never serve, in many homes, at least the homes that I've seen, so there's like, the fish and salad course on a traditional typical Shabbat. Fish and salad, then soup, then main course. She would never serve soup before main course. Because she would say, you're going to eat the soup. And you're going to get filled up with basically water. And then you're not going to want to eat the thing. So no, soup was always at the end. It was like it wasn't dessert, but it was soup. And then there was dessert. But she would always put, and then you were like, Bubby, I can't eat so much. She's like, you didn't sign a contract. Don't worry, eat whatever you want. And then once, so that she would get you to take it. And once you got it, she was on you to make sure that you ate everything that you saw.
That's when I had a friend growing up, he'd eat at his house, and he wouldn't eat something. His mother would say, what about the starving children in China? Name one.
There you go. That's a good rejoinder. I don't know how that became a thing. Like, eat because of... Parents, on some level, are so inconsistent. It's like, well, if Johnny would jump off a roof, would you jump off? Like, we do that, like, don't compare, and then sometimes... Anyway, okay, that's a parenting conversation. So, let's bring it back here. Text number 7. Stanley, please read this one, 258.
Robin Gamliel would say, whoever did not speak of the following three things at Passover Seder has not fulfilled the
So these are three primary components to the Seder. And our premise of tonight's class is that if we look, if we analyze the psychological and spiritual meanings of Pesach, Matzah, and Mar, we are going to find the answer to our question, how we are meant to live our lives. Should the needle point toward minimalism or live it up? To understand that, we need to explore Pesach, Matzah, and Mar, but not yet. We're going to go back in time. Let's go back 400 years before the Exodus. How many years did the Jews spend in Egypt? Do you know? Let me. From the time that Joseph went down to Egypt, which then started the whole chain of events that the brothers came down. There was a famine, and the brothers came down, and then they lived there, and then the slavery started. The whole duration. How many years was that? Do you know?
120.
So that was actually how long the second temple stood. 210, exactly half.
So it's interesting because we talked about this the other day on Shabbos, because we mentioned about the gematria for Gered.
Yes.
210. And so
right.
I remembered that, but then I thought to myself, I started, you know, as I was reading, it talks about being
400. So that's exactly what I'm going to explain. It's supposed to be 400. So what God said to Abraham, which we're about to read. God said to Abraham, text 8. Yeah, God says to Abraham in text 8, he foretells, he tells that his children, Abraham's descendants, will be strangers in a strange land for 400 years. It wasn't 400 years. It was only 210 years. So some say that God reduced it because he had compassion for us. Some say that the 400 is from that moment in time, which it was. So from that communication between God and Abraham, where God kind of tells the future what's going to happen, from that point in time until the Exodus is 400 years. What did God exactly tell Abraham? Let's take a look. Text number 8. Dan, please read text 8, page 259. Thank you. So here God is telling Abraham of the future. He's telling him, in a sense, it's not going to be good, but then it will end up good. Let's focus on the timeline, 400 years, 210 years, it is what it is. It was 400 years from then and 210 years in total. And the truth is, the slavery itself was only 80-something years. Like the real harsh slavery, I don't mean to minimize it, but it didn't start immediately when the brothers came down to Egypt. They weren't slaves immediately. Joseph was still alive, and the original tribes, the original brothers were still alive. And then once they started dying out, and then, you know, Pharaoh kicked in to high gear with his plots, it was about 80-something years of actual slavery.
Did the people start assimilating once they got down there?
You know, the Talmud says that they didn't assimilate, and that's why they merited to be freed, because they didn't, three things they didn't assimilate. They didn't change their name. They didn't change their names. They kept their Hebrew names. They didn't change their language. They still spoke Hebrew. And they didn't change their manner of dress. They didn't dress like the Egyptians. They dressed like the Abrahamic family. So maybe on some level, it seems like they did also worship some of the Egyptian idols, but they still also maintained on some level their distinction. Anyway, the idea here is that God is promising, or God is foretelling, that the Jews would be slaves, and then afterwards they would leave with great wealth, with possessions, and then great wealth. And the truth is, God ensured that that would be the case. In other words, that the Jews would not only leave, but would leave with the stuff. Where did this happen? Famous insight into the ninth plague. Text 9a. And
for 3 days. But for all the children of Israel, there was light in their dwellings.
Now, the commentaries are struck by this plague, no pun intended. They're kind of confused because all of the other plagues, it seems like the Egyptians are being harmed. They can't drink, they can't cook, their skin is afflicted with this, their animals are dying, they're being attacked by wild animals, they're being plagued by hail, like all of this stuff, death and destruction, it's mayhem is happening. The ninth plague is very interesting. The ninth plague is just darkness. And maybe you can't move and you can't go around, but like, is it really so bad? Like, what's happening? What's the point of the plague? So the commentaries address it. Rashi addresses it in text 9b. Very interesting take. Continue. Yeah.
Now, why do you bring darkness upon the Egyptians? The Israelites searched the Egyptians dwelling in the darkness and saw their belongings. When they were leaving Egypt and asked for their possessions, and the Egyptians said, "We have nothing," the Israelite would say to him, "I saw it in your house, and it is in such and such a place."
Now, Rashi didn't make this up. He got it from the Midrash and the Talmud. And the Talmud and the Midrash say that at the ninth time of the ninth plague, so the Egyptians couldn't see. It wasn't like there was an objective darkness. The Egyptians couldn't see. But the Jews could see, even in the Egyptian homes. So although the Egyptians couldn't see and couldn't move, the Jews could move freely, and they could see what was going on. It was like the adult show where that girl would put her fingers together and freeze time, but she could move around. Or not. Anyway, so the Jews could freely move around and see what was going on and go through the Egyptians' possessions, which then came into play when the Jews left after the next plague, the final one, the 10th plague, and the Jews said, "Hey, give us your gold, give us your silver, give us your stuff." And they said, "Well, we don't really have anything. Oh, here's a little coin, a token of appreciation. Thank you. Here's a parting gift." The Jews said, "Well, that's not exactly true. I saw your candlesticks. I saw your silver, I saw your gold, I saw your jewelry, I saw all this stuff, and it's in the drawer. Do you want me to check? Because I'm pretty sure I just saw that like a few weeks ago." So the Egyptians were stuck, and they gave the Jews all these possessions. In other words, God, according to this, God orchestrated a plague in order to fulfill his promise to Abraham that the Jewish people would leave with possessions and great wealth. So in order that God would be able to say, or in order that God sought, fulfilled his promise, so ninth plague happened, and the Jews left with great wealth. Take a look at text 10a. This is a very direct source that this great wealth possession thing happened.
"Please speak into the ears of the people, and let them borrow, each man from his friend, and each woman from her friend, silver vessels and golden vessels."
This is God telling Moses to tell the people. God tells Moshe, "Hey, please tell..." I don't think he said, "Hey." Or maybe he did. He said, "Hey, tell the people to go to the Egyptians and borrow/take their gold and silver vessels. And when they say we don't have, then fill it in with text 9b. But God said, I want you to do this. But look at the opening word. What's the opening word of text 10a? Please. In the Hebrew, it's daber na. Nun aleph. Na means please. God says, not just tell the people, but please tell the people. It's almost like he's beseeching. It's almost like God is, I don't want to use the word begging, but it's like God is saying, please. He's entreating Moses to do so. Why this language of beseeching, text 10b? Please continue, Rashi explains.
The Hebrew word na, used in the verse, is an expression of request. The verse is saying, I ask you, Moses, to instruct them about this, to ask your neighbors for a vessel, so that the righteous man, Abraham, will not say, God, fulfilled your promise, and they will enslave them and oppress them, but you did not fulfill the rest of the promise of afterward they would go forth with great possession.
In other words, God did not want Abraham, Avram, to come after him and say, hey, you, more haste, God did not want Abraham to say, you fulfilled your prophecy, your promise of the slavery, but they didn't get the wealth and the possessions. So God tells Moses, okay, you're about to go, but before you go, you need to do this for me, because I told Abraham that this is going to happen, so make sure that it happens. The people should go and get the silver and gold vessels to leave with great wealth and possessions, and then we're cool. Clearly, this idea of taking the possessions of Egypt was a very fundamental thing. And not only because God promised it to Abraham, because then you can ask the question, why did God tell Abraham? Why couldn't he just tell Abraham, it's not always going to be good. Your people, your children, your descendants will be enslaved. But afterwards, it'll be good. Why did he throw in the promise of the possessions and the great wealth? So the Kabbalists, yes.
And 10a, going backwards.
Yes.
Would neighbor be better than friend there?
Yes.
I'm assuming they weren't friends.
Correct. Maybe they were tennis partners. Joking. Squash. No. Pickleball. You know pickleball? Really? Pickleball. It's a, yeah, it's a, it's huge. Huh?
There's a baseball term, pickle. It's when you get somebody to run this.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's...
Is it similar to that?
No. As far as I know, no. Anyway, one day we'll have a Chabad in town pickleball league on the Beltline. It'll be a whole thing. It'll be a whole thing. Okay, let's continue. So, text 10C. Look what the Talmud says about this. The Talmud is explaining that when it came time for the 10th plague and Moses says, hey guys, go to the Egyptian neighbors and collect their gold and silver, what did the people say? Can we just go? Like, we don't need that stuff. We'd rather just leave. Text 10C. One more.
The Jews said to Moses, if only we could get out with our lives. A parable to illustrate this, they were like a man who was kept in prison, and people told him, tomorrow they will release you from the prison and give you plenty of money. And he answered them, I beg you, let me go free today, and I shall ask nothing more.
In other words, I'd rather leave a day early than get... Now, would we... This is a question, right? Would you leave today without the money or tomorrow with the money? You could see it go either way. But clearly the Jews, according to this Talmudic passage, the Jews were saying, we'd rather leave, we'd rather go now than do this whole taking the possessions from the Egyptian neighbors and everything. So why was it such a big deal for God? Why did Hashem tell Avram? Why did God tell Abraham that they would leave with possessions of great wealth? And then why did Hashem make sure to facilitate that? Who cares about the stuff? Let the Egyptian wealth stay in Egypt. People would rather just leave and live their own lives and make their own living. There was not this deep desire, other than God's desire, there wasn't this deep desire amongst the people to go back and take the stuff from the Egyptians. So why was that such a divine objective? And the answer is, based on the Kabbalistic teachings, that it's not for the wealth. It wasn't about capturing the wealth of Egypt as much as it was capturing the spiritual energy that was embedded in the possessions of the Egyptians. And this touches on the mystery of the universe and the mystery of the sparks of the universe. So let me fill this in.
It also makes the story of the golden calf more interesting.
It does make it more interesting because that ultimately did come from Egypt as well, right? That came...
They had to have some place to get the gold to make the golden calf.
That's where it was. But before we get to the golden calf, let's leave it with the positive end, right? That the Jews took it and they did good things with it. Like they built the Mishkan and other things. What was the significance of that? So the Arizal teaches, Rabbi Yitzchak Gloria, he teaches that we are all human beings are on a hide and seek mission. I don't know if that's the right term for it. Maybe it is. Basically our search and, not search and destroy, but search and elevate. We each roam the earth, and our mission is to encounter the things that we encounter and to utilize them for a holy purpose. So you find something that can be used to do a mitzvah or used somehow within the service of Hashem, and you utilize that thing for that higher purpose, so you are now revealing the truth of that thing. You're saying that's not just a piece of wool, that's a talit, that's a prayer shawl in waiting. And now what you've done is you've made the wool transparent to the divine will. You've made it a medium, a conduit to fulfilling God's will. And in doing so, you've elevated, let's use the Kabbalistic words, you've elevated the sparks of godliness and holiness embedded in that piece of wool. So, imagine a dark landscape, but if you have these special glasses, right, if you have the infrared or not, night vision goggles, right? Military, right? Night vision goggles, excuse me, you can see things. You can see things, or even they have that blue light or that ultraviolet light where you can see stuff right? You can see sometimes they put the stamp on you at the amusement parks, and then they have that thing, that wand, that you can see it. It's like, oh, it shines. Like, I didn't know that. I didn't realize that was there. So there's light. There are pieces of light, fragments of light. The Kabbalists could see it straight up. They had that vision. You and I, we typically don't see it. So we assume that whatever we're doing, there's something to pull out, extract from there, and utilize for a positive purpose. But the point is that there are these sparks, 288. Kabbalah, the Arizal says, 280 sparks. Veruach Elokim merachefet. The Spirit of God, in the book of Bereshit, the book of Genesis, right at the beginning, it says, the Spirit of God hovered upon the earth. Merachefet is a euphemism, is a hint to there being rapach, resh, peches, 288 sparks of God. Merachefet, rapach, 288 sparks of holiness. This goes back to the shattering of the vessels, very Kabbalistic ideas that we don't have time to cover tonight. There was a shvirat hakelim, a shattering of the vessels. These 288 sparks, shards of light, broke and became embedded deep within the material world around us. And our job is seek and elevate. Go around, find the sparks, and elevate it. These 288 sparks were further subdivided and broken down into smaller pieces, smaller residual sparks, and therefore we have more than 288. It says that the Jews refined 202 of the 288 primary sparks. All the way 3,000 years ago, we covered 202 out of 288. We're still working on 86. That's a lot of sparks. Or that's a lot of time for 86 sparks. These are harder. Yeah.
When did that happen?
Rav. Erev Rav. Vagam Erev Rav. Ola Imohem. Also, the mixed multitude went out with them. Erev Rav. The mixed multitude. Multitude is Rav. Resh Bet is 202. So Arizal says, what does it mean, the mixed multitude? It doesn't mean they took people, Egyptians, that went with them. It means they took the sparks of Egypt with them. And those were 202. Rav, 202 out of the 288. This is all Lurianic Kabbalah. It's all from the Arizal, from Tzfat, in the 1500s. Straight up. So, the Rizal says that what was the purpose of taking out the wealth and possessions of Egypt? It was about taking out the materialism to then convert it into a Mishkan, into a temple for God. And through that, we would raise the sparks. Raising the sparks means you're utilizing a thing that doesn't look like it's godly for a godly purpose. So you're using Egyptian possessions that are not God, it's not being used for a godly purpose, using them, transforming them for a godly purpose, boom, you've converted it now into something divine, into something holy, into something that now bespeaks divine transparency. It's no longer saying, I exist, that thing, it's saying God exists. A Mishkan, a menorah in the Beit HaMikdash, the candelabra, does not say, I'm a candelabra. It says, this is God's candelabra. The gold ceases to be self-identifying, and we cease to look at gold as a thing unto itself, and we look at it as transparent, see-through to the divine reality, to the truth. That's what it means to elevate the spark. Every time we take food on a more mundane level, you take food and you eat it. You say a bracha before and a bracha afterwards, a blessing before and after, and you have in mind that you're eating it to get to take the energy out of it and utilize it for a higher purpose, do mitzvah, study Torah, do good deeds, etc., that elevates the experience and elevates the food that you're using and extracts the spark and pulls it out for reclaims the spark that's embedded in that food. That's a quick Kabbalistic overview. Therefore, God tells Abraham, not only are they going to leave Egypt, they're going to take the wealth. Because if not, why were they there? To waste time? If they're there on a seek and elevate mission, justified. But what did they spend 210 years there for? Why did they spend 80 years of harsh labor? What was the point? They become stronger? Give me something else. Give me something deeper. If they leave with the possessions of Egypt and then use those possessions to build a home for God, now we're talking. So God says to Moses, please tell the people before they leave. I know everyone wants to get out. Don't leave yet. Go to the neighbors and take their stuff. You're going to need it. And I need you to take it because this is the whole purpose, the whole point of all of this. Extract the sparks. The truth is, this is our purpose, you and I, this is our purpose in life. And anytime you find yourself in Egypt, in a dark place, God forbid, we should never find ourselves in negative places. But if you find yourself in a difficult situation, you should know one thing. You're meant to take a spark out of it. If you leave, if you run for the hills and you leave, but you don't take anything with you, and I'll leave that up to you to define for yourself what that means, take something with you. Because I think it's better if it's open-ended. If you don't leave with anything, if you don't borrow, if you don't take anything out with you, then it was a waste of time. And God doesn't play tricks with us. There are no wastes of time. So if you find yourself in Egypt, if you find yourself in a tough spot, in a difficult place, in a dark space, know one thing. You're meant to extract something from this experience. There's meant to be a silver lining, a spark, whatever you want to call it. There's meant to be, I don't mean a happy end. It doesn't even mean that. It means there's some purpose that needs to be extracted from this experience.
Why you were there.
If you didn't take anything out of it, then maybe don't leave yet. That's what God tells Moses. Don't leave until you're taking something out. If you come out of Egypt empty-handed, well, at least we're alive. For what? Why are you alive? You're meant to get the sparks. Did you get the sparks? It's like you're sent by a country on a mission. You're a spy. And you're sent to collect information. And it's a very dangerous mission. And you go behind enemy lines. And you survive. You come back and say, wow, I made it out alive. Well, what'd you get? Nothing. Why do we send you? The purpose of this mission wasn't to survive the mission. It was to pull out something. If you didn't pull out, if you didn't extract, then you wasted time. So we're meant to extract. The Jews extracted. They took the wealth, etc. Make sense so far? Okay. I paraphrase now text 11. I paraphrase text 12. Let me read text 12 just so you see it inside in the original Kabbalistic language, because I think there's power to seeing it in the original. This is written, by the way, the Arizal didn't write. He taught, he passed away young, he didn't put pen to paper. His student, he had many students, but his primary student, Rabbi Chaim Vital, he wrote down, he penned the Arizal's teachings. So all of Lauriana Kabbalah that we have written down was written by his student, and his student's name was Chaim Vital, and he wrote it in books using his own name, called like Eitz Chaim. His name was Chaim. Eitz Chaim, like Tree of Life. Okay, text 12, Eitz Chaim. It is known that the purpose of the mitzvot are to refine and sublimate the form and the material. The spirit itself does not need refinement. And the only reason it was integrated in the form and the material was to draw down a light that would rectify it. For this is the reason the soul descended upon this world, to rectify and to sublimate it, similar to the exile of the Shekhinah, which is to sublimate the godly sparks that have fallen. Sublimate is a weird word. I don't think that's something that we use in our contemporary language. The Hebrew word is levarer, which really means to refine or to select, to choose. Birur is something that, borer, is a prohibited work on Shabbat. If you look in the code of Jewish law, you can't do borer, levarer. You can't do that on Shabbat. You know what that means? If you have a mixture of stuff, and some of it you like, some of it you don't like, you cannot select out the stuff that you don't like. You can't sort. You can't separate on Shabbat. Levarer doesn't mean sublimate. I don't even know what sublimate means. It doesn't mean sublimate. I know what it means. It's not 100%. It's fancier. It's not accurate. What it means is to separate. In other words, do we have the mindfulness when engaging in material activities to separate the husk, the shell, from the inside, from the spark? The outside from the inside. By the way, without getting too, I'm going to speak very quickly on this and not get detailed. Our body does a good job at this. A healthy body does a good job. We put in food, and the body, it does birur. The body separates. It takes what it needs, and the rest it discards. That's the way the body, a healthy body, that's the way a healthy body works. It takes in the nutrients, takes in the energy, takes in what it needs, and the rest it eliminates. That's it. The human being is meant to do so as well. When you're involved in a physical experience, and it take what you need, take what your soul needs, take what God needs, and leave the rest behind. Don't get caught up in it. Why do you need to get caught up in it? Even when it comes to eating, I always say this. Many of you may have heard me say this. I've never seen somebody take a selfie by the gas station, pumping gas. It's like, oh my gosh, look at this gas. It's 87, it's 89, whatever the numbers are. It's not a thing. How many food selfies are there? Why? If we looked at food, at eating, as fueling up so that we can get to the next stop, what do we do when we pull our car into the gas station? It's getting close to empty, but we have further to go. We need fuel to go on. It's very clear what the objective of the fueling up is. It's not because fuel is amazing. It's so that we can continue going. Why do we eat? That's the question. Let's get back to it. So, right? Make sense? Why do we eat? Does it become an experience, or is it about refueling so that we can continue going on? That's the question. Bira means that it's very clear what the objective is. Yes, it's very clear what we're doing, what we're not doing. We're separating. Yeah.
So I just want to ask, did you say that we can't separate? They're called klipa, like the
klipa. No, we can. We're meant to.
Okay, so we should separate.
That's our mandate. Our mandate in life is to engage with physical things, but to be mindful and to say, look, I don't need the negativity of it. I just want what I need and what God needs from this.
The reason I was asking is because the, you know, taking, for example, if you go back to taking possessions, at that moment you're taking them, you're not really separating. You're just taking. And then
at a later point, we're going to divide. Exactly.
So
yeah. And by the way, as was mentioned before, the golden calf kind of threw a monkey wrench in that.
Yeah.
Maybe they took what they didn't need.
Maybe they misused what they took and they didn't fully separate the good from the bad. I mean, we're human beings. Who's going to get this perfect? A tzaddik will get this perfectly right. But and Moses got it right. He was on the mountain. He didn't sin. He didn't engage in the golden calf. Most of us, we're not perfect. So sometimes we're very much into the husk. We're into the klipa. We're into the shell. And we forget. We don't see the spark. We forget. We think it's all about the materialism, and we forget. Which brings us back to our point. So let's get back to the Seder plate and the three items, Pesach, Matzah, Mar, and close it out, because we're right at the time. A little bit after the time. So three things, Pesach, Matzah, Maror, very important. Pesach is the Paschal lamb offering. Matzah is that crunchy goodness that we love. And Maror, the bitter herbs. In Jewish law, it says, today, nowadays, there are these three items comprise three distinct categories of Jewish law. The matzah is a biblical commandment to eat matzah. There's a biblical commandment. A Torah commandment for you and I to eat matzah the night of Passover. Torah says, eat matzah on this night. Biblical, straight up biblical commandment. Like Shabbat, Shofar and Rosh Hashanah, Sukkah and Sukkot. Matzah on the night of Passover is a biblical commandment. What about mar, bitter herbs? It's not biblical. It's rabbinic. Today, why? In temple times, it was biblical. Today, it's only rabbinic. Because the Torah only tells us about eating mar together with the Paschal lamb. It says, when you eat the Paschal lamb, al matzos, umerorim yochlu, eat it together with your matzah and your mar. That's the only time mar is mentioned in the context of the Paschal lamb. We don't have a Paschal lamb today. Theoretically, you don't need to eat the mar today. Matzah is a separate commandment. Matzah has that verse with the Karban Pesach, with the Paschal lamb, and it also has a separate verse that says, eat matzah on the night of Passover. So that's still in effect today. But the mar is only commanded in the context of the Paschal offering. We don't bring the offering today, so there's no need to eat mar. The rabbi said, eat mar anyway. Rabbinic commandment to eat mar. What about the Paschal lamb itself? We don't eat it at all. Three different levels. The matzah is a biblical commandment to eat. The mar is a rabbinic today. Rabbinic commandment to eat the mar. And the Paschal lamb, zecher. We remember it, we don't eat it. We have a little shank bone on the Seder plate. We eat a little afikomen, matzah, extra matzah to remind ourselves of it. We don't actually eat a Paschal lamb. Not even rabbinically. Understand the three levels? Matzah is biblical. Mar are bitter herbs, rabbinic. And the Passover, the meat, the Passover lamb, we don't eat it all. The Rebbe wrote in 1941 in his journal, the Rebbe wrote that these three items represent three areas of our lives. The meat, the matzah, and the maror. The meat represents material indulgence. Meat, indulgence. Matzah is basic staple, flour and water. Maror is a vegetable. It's kind of in the middle. You with me on this? If we're ranking food items and how fancy or how you know, opulent and how luxurious they sound and feel and taste. Meat is all, assuming that one is not a vegetarian, right? Meat is at the top, matzah is at the bottom, and mar is in the middle. So Jewish law says as follows, and I'm paraphrasing the Rebbe's incredible insight. When it comes to matzah, the Torah says eat matzah. When it comes to basic necessities and our obligation to eat and then reclaim the sparks of that food, basic necessities, you have to eat to survive. So eat what you need to and be mindful of your mission in extracting the sparks. What about the meat? The meat is dangerous, dangerous territory. Because the meat is so luxurious, because the meat is so opulent, it therefore tests the metal of the human being. It tests the integrity of the human being. Can you eat the sizzling steak and be mindful of why you're eating? Can you look at an amazing burger, the all-American beef burger from Fuego Mundo? Can you look at that and remember your soul, retain your spiritual integrity? Or are you going to succumb to the, I would say, sensuality, if you will, of the experience, of that eating experience? That's why the Talmud says, an Am HaAretz should not eat meat. A person of the earth, a person of the land, in other words, a person that's not always so mindful should actually not eat meat except for Shabbat and holidays. The point is, matzah is a staple. We have to eat. I mean, flour and water, bread, basic sustenance, we have to eat. So then the Torah says, eat it. Be mindful, careful, but eat it. It's fine. The Paschal lamb, the meat, today, don't eat. What about the vegetable? The vegetable are those areas in life that are in between. Where Torah says, maybe you don't have to, but the rabbi said, we trust you, go for it. It's a little bit more luxurious. The vegetable, it's not like simple bread. It's a little bit more advanced, but it's not meat. Torah says, this you can have. Let's read this inside. I'm going to read a few texts, and then we're going to close it out with some practical takeaways. Just so you see how the Rebbe writes it. Text 14:267. Some things are absolutely necessary. One cannot live without them. Then there are things that are considered luxury items. And some things fall in between these two categories. Using food as an example, the Rebbe writes, the first category would include bread. Those are things that we absolutely need to survive. The second category would include meat. Those are things that are luxury. And the third, middle category, would include vegetables, which, like bread, is a staple, but nevertheless, not as vital. Let's skip a few texts, all the way to text number 17. Since the temple was destroyed, the Rebbe writes, there is no commandment to eat the Passover sacrifice, which is meat. The commandment to eat matzah, bread, which is necessary, does apply biblically now, just as during the time of the temple. The commandment to eat mar vegetables does not apply biblically. Let's skip that line. But that principle describes only the letter of the law, the logical state of being from the perspective of biblical law. However, the words of the sages transcend the natural order, Hishal Shalot, and the rabbis decreed that we may make use of vegetables in our times, hence the rabbinic enactment to eat the mar, to definitely eat the mar at our Seder plates. And the message for us in life is as follows. There is no lessening the challenge of dealing with materialism and walking away unscathed. That was a very long sentence, but here's what I mean. It's dangerous. It's dangerous territory. It's dangerous to go into enemy territory and to try to survive that and remain intact with our spiritual integrity intact. It's very difficult. To extract the spark, you're going to enemy territory. Are you going to take the spark or are you going to be taken by the meat or by the experience? It's kill or be killed. It's extract or be extracted. Someone's going to overwhelm the other. Can you and I handle it? That's the question. So, when it comes to things that you need to survive, there's no question. You need to do it. Be careful. But it's survival. When it comes to things that are luxury items, maybe you don't need to put yourself in danger like that. When it comes to middle ground, the rabbi said, we trust you. Maybe the Torah says, nah, but the rabbi said, we trust you. Go in. It doesn't mean that we can't eat meat in the weekday. It doesn't mean literally meat. We're talking about a Paschal lamb, a mar vegetable, and a piece of matzah as a template for living. the things that we need materially to survive in this world, the things that we need in our lives, you get a house, maybe you need a car, depending where you live, whatever. Those things you need. Be careful. You need to eat. Be careful. Things that we don't need, absolutely don't need, maybe it's better not to get ourselves mixed up in that stuff, because it could be a distraction. What about things that are on the borderline in between? The rabbi said, go for it. If you feel strong enough, go for it. So the message for us is as follows. The opening statements, texts 1, 2, 3, and 4, and 5, and 6, they painted conflicting messages. Should we minimize our materialism or maximize our materialism? According to Chassidus, Kabbalah, according to the way the Rebbe explains it, it depends. Certain things, throw yourself into it. Certain things, you have to go for it. Don't look back. Be mindful. Do it the right way, but you need to go in. Certain things, you don't need to touch. Certain things are a middle ground. No one defines that for us. These are areas that we need to draw our own lines. It might be easier if someone else drew those lines for us. Each of us needs to draw those lines. The main thing, though, is to be mindful. We're meant to improve the world, reclaim the sparks, and live healthy lives. Let's not forget why we're here. Let's not succumb to material temptation around us. And of course, let us have a very happy and healthy and kosher and blessed Pesach together with our family and friends. May we experience the true Seder, the Seder with the coming of Mashiach, when we will have once again the meat of the Paschal offering. We'll be ready to take on even the luxurious challenges with confidence and with flair and with charisma, spiritual charisma, to extract those sparks. May it be soon, speedily in our days, and let us say, Amen.